Okay. Ready to ramble. Hiking boots on. So, those of you who are here at the start of the evening will have heard Jnanav Archa say that I'm just approaching my 40th anniversary as a Dhammachari. I'm 39 years, 11 months and 3 days as Dhammachari Subhuti. And inevitably, when these sort of anniversaries come up, and it's quite a big one, 40 years, it's more than two-thirds of my life. Is that right? No, slightly less than two-thirds of my life. I'm flattering myself or underplaying or something. You inevitably look back a bit. And what I've noticed in looking back is, well, first of all, I could say that, in a way, I haven't changed at all. That would be very reassuring for you who are coming to this centre for the first time. Don't worry, you won't change. But I have a strong sense that, in a certain sense, yes, I don't feel I've really changed at all. And what I mean by that is that the sort of thread of inspiration, a thread of continuity that stretches all the way through my life, into my life as a Buddhist, my life as an order member, as a committed Buddhist. And in a certain sense, that's not changed at all the way through. It's become more conscious. And of course, at times I've managed to hide myself from it quite effectively. But nonetheless, I don't really feel that I'm doing anything different now to what I've been sort of more vaguely and inarticulately trying to do from very, very early in my life. And there are a number of different threads to that I could follow through, but I wanted, and it's an old man's privilege, to reminisce a bit, which, since you're a captive audience, you have to put up with. I remember my first moment of consciousness. I don't know exactly how old I was, but I must have been about 2, maybe 1.5. It's difficult to say. And exactly how much of that memory is real memory and how much is the dressings of later reflections, it's very difficult to say. But in this memory, which I can call to mind very, very easily, I'm lying on my back and I'm just looking upwards into, well, I don't really know what I'm looking up into. It's a sort of a vague, foggy light. With hindsight, I've read into the situation a pram. And I know the pram exactly because, you know, my parents lived in a very large house, so they never threw anything away. So that pram hung on the wall for 50 years until I burnt it when the house was sold. So I imagine myself in that pram, not hanging on the wall, but with its wheels on and so forth, because I tried to make a cart out of it at one point, so the wheels went. Anyway, let's not get lost. So I sort of somehow imagine myself lying in this pram, but that's not actually integral to the memory. I've also got a vague sense of some admiring female figures hovering above me. Looking down on me. I suspect that's also back red. You know, vague longings. But what's absolutely, well, I can't say it's absolutely clear because, in a way, it's so slender or so slight, the memory. It's this memory of just being aware. Just looking up into the light of day. It's definitely this world, the light of this world, but featureless and without any spin to it. I'm just aware. There's no interpretation, no curiosity in a way. I'm just aware. That's what I recall. And it's sort of a very peaceful sense of just being aware, just being awake. It's the peace that precedes turbulence and peace, if you see what I mean. It's the peace that is just of awareness, of being aware. I can't say I've kept a memory of that alive all my life, but there's something in that experience that has constantly returned to me through my life. Moments of simply being aware, without any, as I put it, spin to it. There's all sorts of incidents that I could recount, but I will spare you. I'll tell you a few just to make my point. Honestly, that's only why. I used in earlier life to be very allergic to needles. And I only had to be shown a needle and I'd be flat on the floor. Which was very difficult when I came to go out to India regularly, because regularly I have to have 6 jabs. I've just stopped having them now. And a few times I've passed out on some poor doctor. I once had acupuncture. And I came to with the acupuncturist panicking over me because I passed out. I realised how you deal with this, by the way, for anybody who shares this phobia. The main thing is to keep breathing. I think one passes out because one stops breathing in order to deal with the fear. Anyway, be that as it may, what's really interesting is the moment when you come to. Because there's an absolute discontinuity. You suddenly drop out of consciousness. Everything's proceeding along quite nicely. The acupuncturist is hovering over you. The doctor is there. And then suddenly you've gone. And then suddenly you're back. And there's often, in my experience, no reference. I've absolutely no idea where I am or what's going on. I remember a particularly acute experience of this, not with needles, with Indian food, which is sometimes rather the same thing. I remember going to the airport in Bombay, and an Indian friend was with me. We ate in a hotel. Sorry, before I got to the airport, I was going to stay the night in a hotel. And we had a meal together. And he was a bit sniffy about the meal, but I thought it was delicious. That night, he left me, and he was going to come and collect me in the morning and escort me to the airport and make sure I left India. And I woke up in the middle of the night as sick as I've ever been. And I remember just sort of managing to crawl to the toilet bowl and just retching. And then hauling myself back literally on hands and knees to bed and passing out. The next thing I knew was that there were 3 people standing at the end of my bed looking down on me. And I looked up at them. I had absolutely no idea where I was, who they were, even in a sense, who I was. And it was blissful. I was completely at peace. I really didn't care who they were. I didn't care why they were there. I didn't care why I was there. I just felt completely happy, at peace, just aware. I began to be aware that one of these people standing at the end of my bed was panicking, because it was my friend come to collect me, and I clearly had no idea who he was. And the management, who had opened the door with a pass key at his insistence, were now beginning to look suspiciously upon him. So I sort of dragged myself back into the world. But there's this moment when, in this case, it lasted for quite a long time. I was just aware without any spatio-temporal coordinates, and I couldn't have cared less, because the experience of simple, pure awareness was so delightful. That I've experienced a number of times. It hasn't made me want to have injections. In fact, I still avoid them if I possibly can. I think they're unnatural to have something stuck into you like that. The experience often of coming to is a brief moment of this release from space and time, of just consciousness. I've experienced this under other circumstances. You can tell from my age that I was probably a hippie, like most of the early order members. And I've had quite a few experiences under the influence of certain substances. I'm not going to tell you much, don't worry. I'm not going to regale you with my war stories from the marijuana and LSD fronts. But I remember a very telling experience, which is worth recounting because it makes my point. I remember having smoked some quite strong marijuana and driving with some friends up to London. Actually, we were going to the Buddhist Centre, as one did in those days, one went forearmed. But I was driving up to the Buddhist Centre, and I was at the wheel. I don't advise this, please. Don't try this on your own at home. But I was driving up from Kent, where I was living at the time, up the M20. It's a nice straight motorway. And I was driving along at night, and I became aware that it wasn't that I was travelling along the motorway, it was the motorway was travelling along under me. And the road was sort of sliding under me. I was completely stationary, and the car was sort of stationary around me, but the road was sliding underneath me, and the sides of the motorway, the countryside around me, was sliding along past me. And I was completely at ease and peaceful and just driving along with the road. Well, not driving along, just sitting there with the wheel in my hand. And the road was sliding through me, really, and beyond me, and the sides of the road passing me by. And eventually, London brought itself to me. The experience was that I'd slipped into consciousness as something larger than space. Space existed within my consciousness, not consciousness within my space. Not consciousness within space. So it wasn't that I was located in space. Space was located in consciousness. And for a while, I was... It's very difficult to know how to put it, but identified with consciousness rather than this structuring of consciousness in terms of space and time that we add on to it. I won't tell you any more war stories, fascinating as they are. Once you get going on these things, you can just go on and on. And I've had, you know, like probably most people, many moments in my life under the influence and not under the influence. Sometimes in situations where it's obvious that there's been a trigger, looking at art, for instance, just suddenly looking at a painting and being precipitated into a state of pure looking, without any sort of judgment or any imposition of conceptual structures upon what you're seeing. So you're just seeing. Meditation, obviously, perhaps, the most powerful and most systematic experience. But also experiences in very ordinary situations. For some reason, washing my hands after going to the toilet seems to be an extremely powerful precipitant of this kind of experience. I suppose because your mind is completely relaxed and you're just washing your hands, you're not doing anything in particular. And find yourself just out of the situation, but in it at the same time. And these sort of experiences came to me before I encountered the Dhamma, before I encountered Buddhism. And they're amongst the kinds of experience, there are ones of other kinds too, but they're perhaps the most important of the experiences that have really been the driver of my life, that have led me into the Triratna Buddhist order and have really shaped my life around my commitment as a Buddhist. My glimpses from a very early age that There's something about consciousness that can't be contained within the net of space and time, to give in brief what I'm going to talk about, if I can manage it, in greater length over these 3 days. There's something about consciousness that I've experienced, I don't think I'm particularly special in that way, for some reason, for no reason, for reasons to do with other lives, reasons to do with circumstances, for reasons I just can't account for, that has consistently indicated to me that the structure that I impose upon myself and my world is merely a structure. It's a construction, which awareness itself is greater than, to put it like that. It's this that I really want to explore. I want to explore what this awareness is, because if I'm right, if my own intuition or my own experience is correct, this dimension of consciousness is present all the time. It's present in every moment of experience. It's just that usually we are caught up with the structures that we impose upon our experience. But there's a dimension of experience, which is the dimension of, let's call it, pure awareness, pure consciousness, that is never never lost, never tamed, and always fresh. It's always there. And the task, really, is to bring that out more into the foreground, and mix my metaphors furiously. So I hope in brief I've kind of captured a little bit of a flavour of what I'm going to be talking about, and you've got some idea, and perhaps also some of you will already have some reference in your own experience. As I say, I don't think this is particularly special. It's not a specially Buddhist experience. It's just that the Dhamma gives a particularly articulate structure for it, for understanding it, and a particularly agile way of maturing it and bringing oneself so that it's more systematically and regularly part of one, or recognised as part of one. But it's part of just being alive, just being aware. It's natural to us. So I'm hoping that by talking about it in this sort of way, I'll accentuate it for myself and maybe bring it more to life for you. And we can then see how all the things that we do in the context of the Dhamma relate to that. Not quite sure how I'm going to do this, but I've done what I like to do in these talks, which is spin the ball, and we'll see where it goes from here. That's the right metaphor. But yes, what I'm trying to get at is that there's something for every one of us right now that we probably are not sufficiently aware of, or that gets funny, the language there, we're not sufficiently allowing, that is completely fresh, completely open, not entrammelled in the structures that we impose upon our experience, we have to impose upon it, and that is the source of our hope and possibility. So let me try and flesh all this out. Fool that I am. A venture where angels fear to tread. So the first thing I want to explore a bit is just that the idea, consciousness. It's a really funny idea. Because we've got this word, consciousness. And as soon as you use a substantive like that, as soon as you use a, a noun, you're already into thing. As soon as you say table, of course, you've got an object that out there that you can have some sensory relationship to, that you're applying a label to, that, of course, is not really what it is, but the label itself refers to something objective, something that you can place in relation to other things, that you can number, that you can apply quality to, you can use adjectives in relation to it, you can have a relationship to it, you can act upon it, and so forth. All our language is structured like that. It's structured on the idea that there is a world of things. Those things are multiform and stand in relation to each other, stand in relation to space and time. And they're objective. So when we use a noun like consciousness, albeit an abstract noun, when we use, you know, because when abstract noun is always related to real things. Sweetness relates to a sweet taste, if you see what I mean. So that even when you use an abstract noun, you're not that far away from an objective experience. When you come to use the word consciousness, what is it that you are referring to? What is it that is the experience, the objective experience to which it refers? Well, it doesn't take a lot of thought to realise that there can't be such an objective experience, because consciousness is our word for the arena within which experience takes place, to metaphoricalise. But we inevitably think of it in terms of our experience in the objective world. So you hear people saying, you know, after death, my consciousness, you know, goes on into another body or something like that. And, well, you know, rough and ready that may do under certain circumstances if you go along with that sort of idea. But my consciousness goes. What a weird thing to do. You're sort of talking about it as if it's you know, a car going somewhere. And, you know, you own it. You've got the papers, my consciousness, with an MOT certificate. Some of us would fail miserably. Consciousness just not of that kind. You know, we have to have a word for the category of knowing, of awaring, of being conscious. But, you know, even then I use being conscious. I'm using a verb. But being conscious isn't like any other sort of being, if you see what I mean. It's not like being Subhuti or being English or anything like that. It's far better than being English. It's not a state in that way. It's not a condition. It's the condition of conditions, if you like. It's a really, really difficult thing to think about. And I think that's where we have to start thinking. If we start to think about the unthinkability of consciousness, we begin to get at what it is that we need to get at. I want to be quite clear here that when I talk about consciousness, I'm not talking about mind. Of course, you could use mind as a substitute for consciousness. The term mind is pretty elastic. But by mind, I would understand more mental processes, mechanisms, processes of feeling, processes of thinking, processes of willing, processes of sensing, which to some extent do stand objective. I can identify a sensation very easily. slap yourself. I can objectify that sensation. I can even objectify to some extent, more complex, more subtle, my feelings. Feeling of sadness, happiness, anger, a feeling of delight on this particular situation or whatever. They're actually, there's an objective correlate to them. A thought. You can make your thoughts, your thoughts are objective to consciousness. But consciousness itself is, maybe you could say, part of mind, but it's distinct from those mental processes. In Buddhist psychology, mind is, or rather consciousness, what I'm calling consciousness, is distinguished from mental events. Vijnana is quite different from dhammas, or dharmas. Dharmas here, meaning mental events, the objects of mental activity. Not dharma in the sense of Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Here it's a technical term in Abhidhamma for the objective constituents of experience. So yes, I'm distinguishing between mind and consciousness. I'm not talking about all mental processes, because those are, as I say, to some degree, objective to consciousness. They arise, so to speak, to metaphoricalize, within consciousness. And my goodness, we find ourselves metaphoricalizing a lot when we start talking about consciousness, because you've got nothing else really to get at it with. I can sort of try to think about consciousness, but of course when I think about it, I'm thinking about it. I'm not thinking it. Consciousness is just consciousness. So I could dwell on this much more, and it's worth it. Because when you really begin to recognize the indefinability, the essential unknowability of consciousness, I think you get at this quality that I was trying to indicate through experience in my opening reflections. Consciousness is present in every moment. If consciousness wasn't present in every moment, it wouldn't be a moment. And it's utterly mysterious. Utterly mysterious. This always astonished me in throughout my life. I remember studying and coming across Leibniz's famous question, why is it that there is something and not nothing? He considered this to be the fundamental metaphysical question. His own answer wasn't particularly satisfactory. And of course Heidegger famously took off on that and said that the problem is, or rather what's most interesting is not the something, but the nothing. We should interrogate nothing much more. And there's quite a lot that could be wrung from that in connection with what I'm talking about, but I'm not going to go there now. Heidegger is knots that you can tie yourself in without ever getting out of them. To me, the question isn't really so much why is it there's something and not nothing. What really intrigues me is why am I aware, or what is this awareness? For instance, that first flash of awareness that I talked about in my year and a half or 2 years old incarnation, just appears out of nowhere. There's no build up to it, no sort of, like a cine projector getting going with 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, what comes next, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we are, conscious. It's just suddenly flash, there you are. And that coming out of needle-induced swoon, or bad Indian curry-induced swoon, you're just suddenly awake, suddenly aware. Sometimes you get in the morning, delightful sort of coming to. I've learnt to really savour this and sometimes linger as long as my conscience allows me. The conscience doesn't have much of a look in that face. In that state of mere suspension, of just open consciousness. But it sort of comes from nowhere. It's got no time preceding. It's got no coordinates in terms of time, of space. No coordinates really in terms of self and other. You don't really know who you are. All you know is awareness. And it's kind of miraculous. Not kind of miraculous. It is miraculous. Inexplicable in terms of itself. And you can have a neat, intellectual explanation of it. But the raw experience is indefinable, ungraspable, inexplicable. And in a way, when you're most purely in the midst of that experience, it asks no questions. It is completely self-sufficient, quite satisfying in itself, at its most sort of raw, as I put it. And what seems to me extraordinary about this inexplicable, indefinable, miraculous awareness is that it's present all the time. It's present all the time, it's present now. We're all aware. If you're hearing me at all, you're aware. I'm aware. It's present at every moment of your life, every moment of your experience. And yet, we're hardly ever really aware of it. Although that's such a weird way of talking, isn't it? You'd be aware of awareness. We hardly ever experience it. And again, even that's weird, because experience is very much subject-object formulated. It's grammatically structured. I experience something. But we hardly ever, experience awareness in that sort of pure, raw way. And yet, if we could allow consciousness to be much more present in that sort of way. Oh dear, the language. All the time, so many of our problems would just dissolve away. So much fussing and anxiety and tribulation, so much worry, so much pain, just disappears. Consciousness itself is, in a sense, immune. Of course, when consciousness enters into, again, metaphors, enters into relationship with the other aspects of experience, that it becomes problematic, or that our problems, we become problematic, our problems begin. But consciousness itself is always fresh, open, untrammeled. In certain senses, it's almost useless to say that, because that's a theory. But it's accessible to us if we make the effort to allow it to unfold more fully in our way of experiencing. So this is my topic: this indefinable, unspeakable, aboutable. Element of our experience, which is the indispensable background to our experience, to metaphoricalize, it's that is, in a sense, the most important thing about us, and that our Dhamma life is lived to bring more fully into play. That's what I'm going to talk about. So I've already said it's impossible to talk about and that it's indefinable. And I hope that even in talking about it as indefinable, that gives you some idea of it, that this dimension of experience is not accessible to consciousness. You can't make it an object of consciousness because it is what does the consciousnessing. So that fact itself helps us to begin to sink into it. And that's what we really need to do, is to allow ourselves to sink into it, to relax into it, to rest upon it, so that we're less caught up with the constructions that we impose upon consciousness and more able to rest in this background of consciousness that is always present. So, to proceed further, let me talk a bit more about the way in which consciousness fits into the broader structure of our experience. And I'm going to talk about that in terms of a classic Buddhist classification that I'm sure many of you will have come across, which is the five skandhas, or kanda in Pali. Skanda literally means heap or group. So really it means five categories. They're five filing cabinets, or filing cabinet drawers, into which we can put all the elements of every moment of experience. Here we are, awake, aware, and we've got a broad range of experience right now. Our experience encompasses a broad range of elements. All of those elements can be fitted into, according to fundamental Buddhist ideas, into these five categories. So I'll start to go into those. It's quite a large topic, so I may not be able to finish it today. But the five are, as many of you will know, rupa, which is usually translated as form. I'll flesh that out in a bit. Vedana, which means feeling in the sense of hedonic feeling, pleasant, painful, nice, nasty, happy, sad. Samnya, which means interpretation. It's really the whole ordering of our experience into a structured or constructed picture, so that it makes sense. It's first of all naming, labelling, and so on. Again, I'll come back to this, but interpretation, let's say, samnya. Fourthly, samskara, which means essentially volition, volitional activity, desire, longing, urge, inspiration, and so on. The whole drive to act, whether in body, speech, or mind. And then finally, there's vijnana, which means consciousness. So you can see that vedana, samnya, and samskara, that is feeling, interpretation or conceptualization, intelligence even, and volition, are all really mental events. They're mental activity, but they're different from consciousness. So let me just make all that a bit, I hope, a bit clearer in terms of what's going on for each and every one of us right now. All these five are present, I hope. They have to be. Otherwise, anyway, whatever. I don't know what the consequences are. I don't want to threaten you. rupa, or form, has been defined very nattily by a German Buddhologist, what better, as the objective constituents of the perceptual situation. Got it? We're in a perceptual situation. This is a perceptual situation, brothers and sisters. I'm sure you didn't realise that. But that's what it is. We're perceiving. It's a situation in which we're perceiving. which we've structured. The structure isn't in the situation, it's what we put onto it. So what is in the situation for us immediately is a set of, well, if you could, you could say, sensory data, information arrives at our senses. In a way, we have no idea where it comes from. In this way of looking at things, we're remaining agnostic about the external world. The external world is just one of the ways in which we structure. It's one of the impositions we have upon our experience. It's not inexperience, it's something that we add to it in order to make it intelligible. For the Kantians amongst you, it's a transcendental category. Transcendental not in the Buddhist sense, but that is synthetic a priori, that we bring into our experience rather than a finding in experience. So yes, in this way of looking at things, we're not saying anything about what's out there. We're simply saying that we have sensations. Sensations through the physical senses, sensations of touch, sensations of visual, you know, colour and shape and so forth, smell, sound, taste, even sensations of physical location, kinesthetic sensations, more complex ways of sensing in you know, our spatial location and so on. All of this information arrives at the door of our experience as what's called rupa, form. It's also mental impressions come. You know, you have a dream, and in the dream there are sensations in the dream that appear to be sensations coming from an external world. of course, according to Buddhist tradition, you can also get mental impressions from telepathy and so on. You can get direct experiences through the mind. But yes, we've got these means, we've got these impressions coming, so to speak, in upon us. Those impressions have a direct impact on us, a more or less direct impact upon us. So if you slap yourself, you feel a stinging sensation. If somebody punches you on the nose, you feel acute pain. Somebody strokes you lovingly, you feel, you know, delightful sensations, and so on. You have immediate hedonic sensations. You respond to the stimuli that arrive with you, with you know, like, don't like, pleasant, painful, nice, nasty, happy, sad, etc. Initially, quite directly, you know, a punch, you don't choose is that nice or nasty, by and large, unless you're very, very refined and subtle or extremely stoned. But of course, they get more complex as the mind intervenes more and more. You know that thing when you get a loose tooth and you can fiddle with it and you can sort of... Sometimes the pain can be pleasurable and sometimes it can be painful. Or am I just extremely kinky? but you know, when the mind begins to get involved, pleasant and painful get more complex, and especially when it becomes more and more mental. But every rupa, every sensation has some hedonic tone. Even it's very, very mild, boring, for instance, or not interested, no stimulus. But this is a part of our experience all the time. Every sensation through the mind or through the other senses is eliciting a response of pleasure or pain, whether to a very, very mild degree or quite a strong one. Quite important for us to be much more aware of this. I think a lot of the trouble is we're not sufficiently conscious of this Vedana, this background responsiveness, hedonic responsiveness to the world around us. And of course, what generally tends to happen is that we live our lives to maximise the pleasurable and to minimise the painful. An animal's life, if you like. And humans do that in a much more complex way. So it's important to be aware of that. Then, of course, in order to handle this extraordinary rush of information upon our senses at every moment, we have to have a kind of filter. We have to order it. Yes, we have to interpret it. We have to focus on something, ignore other things. We have to generalise our experience. We're sort of doing that all the time. I've sort of forgotten that you're an audience, if you see what I mean. I'm no longer kind of aware. I'm so caught up with just talking. No, I'm joking aside. You know what I mean? I'm no longer kind of looking at you as particularities. You become a sort of collective communicant in the sense of being the object of communication. Not of the Anglican Church. You're automatically sort of generalising and categorising your experience so that you can keep handling it, so you can look at new experience. So I can take in, you know, the look on your face. If you look bored, I can take that in and respond to it, try and make you laugh, or try and say something more interesting, or whatever. I've forgotten about the room. I'm not really looking at the ceiling. I'm just taking it for granted. It's sort of there. So all the time we're filtering our experience. And that's what's so interesting with those psychedelic drugs, that they take the filter away and you get the whole rush at once. Don't try it at home on your own. But we need to label our experience, to order it. Even animals need to do this. They need to order their experience. They need to be able to ask, well, not to ask, but to decide, eat or not eat. Run away, don't run away. Mate, don't mate, etc. They need to make very basic survival decisions, which are a kind of interpretation. I live in Wales, as is well known from my rambles. I'm always rambling around Wales, but living in Wales, that means I live in a sheep field. And I study sheep quite closely. It's very obvious that sheep are interpreting. They do it incredibly slowly. So you can almost see the process going on as they're deciding, is this the farmer come with something to eat, or is it somebody I need to run away from? They really can't decide. Sometimes you see them frozen, and eventually they run away from me, anyway. So we're doing that, and doing it in a very sophisticated way. All our language emerges out of that capacity. Our ability to talk about the Dhamma arises out of that capacity to interpret the raw flow, undifferentiated flow of experience. Experience doesn't come packaged, it just comes as a flow. And we break it up and order it and manage it, bring it into bite-sized munches that we can swallow and digest, so that we can fulfill our survival ambitions, and if we have any higher ambitions, we can fulfill them. Then, of course, a desire arises in relation to the data that's coming in, the interpretation that we make of that data, and it's guided by the way we understand our experience. If you interpret something in one way, you have a certain response to it. If you interpret it in another way, you have a different response. The example that's often given, I don't know why, is of when you see a figure coming towards you and you can't identify whether it's a man or a woman. And to begin with, you know, if you're very young and male, you see it's, and of a certain persuasion, you see it's a woman and you become interested and try to have a little bit of a closer look. And then when you realise it's not a woman, it's a male, you have a different sort of response. Is he threatening? Is he bigger than me? Is he cleverer than me? Etc. So your interpretation of the raw data, and please supply your own flavours to that illustration, your interpretation of the experience determines your orientation to it, your reaction to it. But that sort of responsiveness is, again, going on all the time, in small ways, in mild responses all the time. So all of that is the kind of more objective dimensions of the perceptual situation that we're in now. The rupa is the purely objective. It what arrives on us, as it were, independent of our mental processes. But then we have these mental processes that gradually form up a world, a mental picture. I am in the shrine room at the LBC listening to a talk by Dhammacharya Subhuti, and I am X or Y from such and such a background, etc. We all fit our experience into this grid of interpretation, which we have to do. If we couldn't do that, we couldn't arrive here, we couldn't get breakfast. A very important consideration. But there's a fifth element, and that is the one that I'm trying to focus on during these days, and that is consciousness. In the early teaching, consciousness is defined in terms of being momentary. Consciousness is, as it were, considered in a quasi-objective way. So it's considered as a momentary arising. A something that arises moment by moment, millimoment by millimoment, independence on previous moments of consciousness in relation to particular mental objects. So in the early tradition, it's said that consciousness is mediated through the sense organs. So the first thing you ask when you're trying to categorize consciousness is, which door is it operating through? So there's eye consciousness operating through the door of the eye, the other senses, and mind consciousness that's operating through the door of the mind. So these are quite important considerations, that consciousness here is momentary. When we say consciousness and we use a word like my consciousness, it sort of sounds like we're talking about something that is stable and fixed, that stands independent of the perceptual situation, having the perceptual situation, but that is unitary and unchanging. But the early tradition emphasizes, no, it's not like that. Each moment of consciousness is fresh, is new, and then it stresses that consciousness arises in relation to an object. At least this kind of consciousness arises in relation to an object. It's vijnana. Jnana is a word that you get forms of in most Indo-European languages. Our English word know is cognate with it. It comes from the same etymological root. Ken in Scottish comes from the same etymological root. You get it in Welsh, Knevin. You get words in most of the Indo-European languages that have the similar k, n, or g, n root. So it just means knowing, if you like, jnana. But vi is a prefix that indicates division, separation, division. Bifurcation. That's the etymological connection with bi. So it's a knowing that is twofold. Here is the inner perceiving aspect. There is the outward perceived aspect. So moment by moment, the awareness arises related to an outward perceived dimension. Yeah? So I'm not going to say any more because time is running out. But I want to leave it there. We'll come back tomorrow to this point of consciousness as arising moment by moment in relation to an object. An inward perceiving dimension that arises in relationship to an outer perceived dimension. That's, if you like, the fundamental of our experience. Moment by moment, there's an inward perceiving and an outward perceived aspect. And it's the inward perceiving aspect that I'm trying to get us more to grips with against this terrible background of it being utterly indefinable and mysterious. So I hope that I've confused you sufficiently to have stopped you thinking that you know there's what I'm talking about, and that you realise at least that I'm talking about something that we can't talk about, thereby excusing myself from all responsibility for anything that I've said. But what I'd like you to do is just reflect more on this aspect of experience, separating out the data, to call it that very briefly, from the hedonic response, nice, nasty, pleasant, painful, happy, sad, good, bad, from the interpretation, it's a this, it's a that, from the response, I want, I'm going to eat it, I'm going to kick it, whatever it is. Independent of all that, there's something, going on. There's something in there that's not definable in that sort of way. So please have a reflect on this, if it's really possible to reflect. Try to sort of, well, in a way you need to look in a mirror and see what you can see. But of course, in looking in the mirror, you're not going to see it. It's a bit like the eye trying to see itself. Because if you look in the mirror, it's not the eye that you see, it's the reflection. So try to think about that, or try to not think about that. Try to sort of experience your way into that. There's a dimension of every moment that we define, we call consciousness, that is indefinable. And that is by far the most interesting aspect of it, to my mind, and where all the possibility lies. It's the element that is free, so to speak, within the situation. The element that cannot be ultimately tied down. I'll leave it there. Leave it with you to reflect if you want to. See if you can work out what on earth I'm talking about. Maybe relate back to those experiences I mentioned if you've got anything of like that. I can't recommend the use of substances. I'm sure you've all done that already, and it's not particularly useful when it comes down to it. In fact, counterproductive in the end. But you've probably all got your moments when you got a little hint of what I'm talking about. And let's just take off from there tomorrow and see where that takes us. We'll take off with this bifurcation of experience into perceived and perceiving, and see where that gets us. Okay? See you tomorrow.
And for now, if we could, actually, no, let's leave our mats.